Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. And this week I have with me James Patton Rogers, who is a war historian and author of the new book, Precision, A History of American Warfare. And specifically, we're going to be talking today about drones, which is really the ultimate, at least currently, expression of precision, which has been essentially American obsession for coming on a little over a century now. Welcome, James.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me, Chase.
Yeah, so I read your book. You know, I really underappreciated how much, even going back into World War One, how much the American public demanded a precision strategy based on essentially ethical constraints, and how that's really carried through to today, where every single president in the drone age has made an emphasis of, we're striking the terrorists, we're not striking the civilians, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was surprised as well. When I first started looking into drones as a war historian, I was really fascinated by the Obama administration. You know, 2008, 2009, the drone program under Obama really started to take off, if you'll excuse the pun. And that's because Obama made this promise to the American people that he would win the good war in Afghanistan, and he would end the illegal war, the bad war, as it was at the time in Iraq. And he would reduce that cost to American military lives, which at that point in time was really skyrocketing. You know, we've got to think back to then, the war on terror, about 60% of U.S. fatalities coming back from those wars were as a result of the IED, the improvised explosive device. And so what did that mean? Well, it meant that those in the infantry could no longer trust the ground that they walked on. And if you're in the infantry, you're taught that, you know, that's what you trust. You have your ground there for cover for everything else. And IEDs would be placed into the walls of compounds. They'd be hidden in the dirt at the side of the road. Then they'd start to be placed into trees in plastic bags. And it became really difficult to be militarily effective on the ground in the war on terror. And then, of course, there were other groups around the world that started to be encompassed within this war on terror. We're talking Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan. And so what are the options here? How does Obama win this war on terror while continuing to try and fulfill his election promise to the American people? Well, this is where the drone comes in. Drones, Obama said, are part of a just war, a war waged proportionately. Simply put, he said, they save lives. And for me, that was fascinating. And so where does this ambition to use the drone, to be proportionate, discriminate, to be precise in war, where does this all come from? And how do we get to the point, that moment in history, where the drone, with its precision missiles on board, were deployable? How did this technology come about? And so that's where my research began. And I thought I'd go back maybe to the Gulf War, maybe we'd go back to Vietnam and laser-guided missiles, but we ended up going all the way back to 1916-17 and to the First World War. And to, you know, as a historian, it's difficult to say a identical moment, but there's certain similarities that resonate. The United States, prior to the First World War, have been involved in policing interventions, bandit wars. So we're talking Cuba, 1905, Nicaragua, 1909, Haiti, 1915. It was these small policing deployments.
Even going back to prior to that, the War of 1812 was in large part fought by nationalized militia units on the Canadian frontier and on the Western frontier. And then throughout the entire westward expansion, it was essentially guerrilla warfare against the Native Americans. And then the Civil War obviously was massed troops, but then going back to the Spanish-American War, the army didn't really exist. It just sort of waltzed into a city that the Navy had captured, and then that continued into the small wars.
Yeah, and so you're providing the exact right context here, because one of the first modern wars, as we might call it, is the Civil War. But then you've got a generation as you're moving through, over a generation as you're moving through into these early days of the Great War, of the First World War, a war that America was never meant to get involved in. So what, the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, the 1904 Roosevelt Corollary, has stated that the US would stay out of the affairs of the brutal old world of Britain and Germany and France. Instead, America would shore up its geographical borders. And so when Wilson ends up taking the United States into the First World War, there is a sense of societal shock. It's called the Lost Generation at this point. You've got over 300,000 American casualties as you're sending your youngest, your best, your brightest over to die in the killing fields of Europe. And as the First World War starts to come to an end, there's this political and there's this public push that the United States would never wage a war like this again. They'd never have the brutal, bloody, muddy trench warfare, war of attrition that they had during the First World War. And so this starts to really play in the minds of some of the early American air power thinkers, people like Brigadier General Billy Mitchell, Colonel Edgar S. Gurell, and they start thinking, right, well, perhaps air power could be a way in which we can solve these very costly ground wars. And again, this is where I kind of have this akin to the thoughts of Obama. Drones are this panacea to solving the costs of the IED. Air power, back in the First World War, might be a way of making sure that we don't have to have these big wars of attrition on the ground. So what's their idea? Well, their idea is if you put loads of money into the U.S. Army Air Service, which one day they hope is going to be an independent branch of the U.S. military, well, people like Gurell come up with this idea of industrial web theory. Now, the idea here is that instead of like the British and the Germans at the time who are dabbling in the ideas of area bombing, morale bombing, the idea that in order to destroy something, you have to destroy everything across a whole city. People like Gurell and Mitchell are saying, well, what if we can drop bombs with pinpoint precision on the enemy war-making capacity and the industry and blunt the teeth of our enemy so they don't have munitions, they don't have oil, they don't have rubber for their tires?
Or perhaps the two most famous examples, attacking the Romanian oil fields, and then also the extremely costly but extremely effective daylight bombing raid on the German ball bearing factories, which destroyed a huge portion of German ball bearing production, which, you know, stupid little steel balls, but it turns out that those stupid little steel balls are absolutely vital for every single machine that ever moved.
They're the choke points of industry, right? And so if you can take those out, and this is the theory, this is industrial web theory, if you can take those out with this pinpoint precision and, may I add, avoid the populace and their livelihood, and I quote the documents here, then you can blunt the teeth, the war-making capacity of your enemy. So when you do meet them on the battlefield, you can move straight through them quickly without having these entrenched wars where you've got equal forces coming against each other, right? So this is a way to end wars quicker. And there was such fervent belief in this. And, you know, I'm sure your listeners, it's a naval history podcast, you'll know all about the sinking of the USS Osprey's Land and Billy Mitchell and all this sort of stuff during that period of time.
As I like to joke, the great naval theorist, General Billy Mitchell, who, despite being a general, was quite the naval theorist who proved to be somewhat correct.
Well, yeah, I mean, in some ways, but the interesting thing about all of this, all right, is that at the same time as this, there are some experimentations going on with early drone technologies. So the first drone is invented in the US experience, at least in 1916-17, tested in the later days of the First World War and deemed to be a little bit useless, but we'll get to that. And this was the Kettering bug. And people involved in this were, you know, future titans of industry. You know, Henry Ford had a tangential role, innovators like Charles Kettering, and the future head of an independent US Air Force, General H.H. Arnold, Henry Hap Arnold. Someone who takes us all the way back to the early days of American air power, someone who was taught to fly by the Wright brothers. And he's there and he's thinking, well, maybe we can invent this uncrewed aerial system, this early drone. They called it an aerial torpedo. And they would set it on rails and point it as the crow flies towards where the target is. Say this is an ammunitions dump, or perhaps, you know, in the future, it might be the ball bearing factory of a city and you're sending this aerial torpedo in. It has a piston engine. But it's like a small biplane, I would say, in size. And you turn the propeller, the amount of rotations that you want it to fly, right? So you preset the distance of this thing. Then it has a very early Sperry gyroscope on board that keeps it level. And so it takes off this rail, sets as the crow flies towards the target, and then once it gets over that target, based on the amount of revolutions of the motor cuts off, it releases a shock in the wings that make the wings drop off, and then, as the innovators at the time would say, it was swooped down on the enemy like a falcon. And now, like I said, in reality, it was worse than useless. In fact, it would spin around in the sky, and every now and then it came back on Arnold and those testing it. And so it wasn't deployed in combat. But it kind of doesn't matter for our story, because that is the ambition, the root of this ambition we see today, to remove humans, for one side at least, from that front line of killing. So to make war less costly for the Americans, and to have that pinpoint precision strike capability to fulfill an element of industrial web theory. Now, what do they do instead of going down the drone path? Now, there are some drone experimentations during the Second World War, including with US Navy pilots like Joe Kennedy Jr., who would fly out in these stripped down B-17s and these Liberators packed full of Torpex explosives that would have a camera on the front and a remote control system that linked back to a C-12 mothership, I think it was called. And then they would use these to try and strike the V-3 weapon sites at Mimiac in the south of France. But that's a different story.
So I guess that raises the question that I wanted to ask, which is, what is the difference between a drone, specifically, say, a suicide drone, and a missile or a torpedo, right? Like, is there a difference, or are these just variations on language here?
You've caught me at a good time. I've just written a chapter where I try and define what drone warfare is and how it's separate from the use of things like missiles. And we're going to jump all over this place, all over history with this podcast, aren't we? I would say that what makes a drone specifically unique in terms of its capabilities in warfare is, first and foremost, this loitering capacity, right? The ability to hover over a target, to adjust fire, and to be able to react dynamically to changing situations on the ground, and to take out that target either by having a deliverable precision missile system on board, so the drone is a weapon system that carries a deployable weapon, or become that, like you say, kamikaze, some call it suicide weapon, some call it one-way loitering munition, into the target itself. Now, added to that, I would say there is the ability to have a much broader array of sensors on board as well, and a multi-use versatility. So the drone today is very much about, you know, ISTAR. We're talking intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, and reconnaissance as well. And the uses of drones are just going up and up all of the time in terms of their strategic and tactical use above and on and into the battlefield. So for me, that is what the drone is, and that is why it's different. I also think it's important to have this concept of drone warfare, just like it's important to have this concept of tank warfare or naval warfare specifically, I guess, because it encapsulates a moment. This last 20 years we've been talking about since the war on terror, where these robotic, remote-controlled systems and increasingly autonomous systems have made this shift from human being directly in the loop of control to humans being more on the loop of control.
So some of those, specifically the loitering aspect, I would say, is probably more definitional of a drone. But that's simply because missiles, I think, are designed not to carry a bunch of extra fuel, because that's not sort of their design. But in terms of the receiving updates, certainly the Navy and presumably the Army and other forces as well have missiles that receive mid-air guidance from the ship, right? Radar and whatnot. And so they're receiving live information, or they can, and then they have a fallback autonomous mode. And so it's not human in the loop, but it is a computer in the loop in terms of updating the missile in terms of what it should do, because the missile has, you know, some onboard capabilities, but the ship has a lot more onboard radar-esque capabilities. And so it can be more guiding there. But if a drone was designed as a short-range drone with a jet engine on the back, would that be, I'm just trying, where exactly are we drawing that line between, does it have to have human in the loop to be a drone, but then, I mean, drones of the future are certainly going to be autonomous.
Drones of the now, Chase. Drones of the now. I mean, we've already had the first use of autonomous drone systems. We've seen during the Second Libyan Civil War, from 2020 onwards, the introduction of things like the Cargo 2 drones by the Turkish that have preset algorithms on board that have target lists. They have the ability to identify what they can strike, and they have the pre-authority to do so without a human making that decision. And this is something that we're seeing increasingly. There's accusations that Israel have this, that Ukraine have been able to take agricultural drone technologies that are able to pick out different parts of the field that need extra care and attention or extra different pesticides, and to take that technology and then to use it to pre-program different targets. I think 65 different targets can be programmed into this drone so that the drone can pick out and then take fire action against those targets. And then Russia has been accused of having the same technologies as well. And of course, we know that the United States, with its replicator program, is looking to actually deeply invest in this, and China the same. So this is most certainly our future. But I definitely take your point. As we've moved forward with, and hopefully, I mean, this is one thing that the book shows as well, is that missile technologies, especially in the experience of nuclear strategy and shifts towards counterforce, well, it was that same investment in those technologies that not only increased the range and the precision and the yield of conventional weapons, but it's that technology that led also into the modern drones. So it's, you can look at it, I guess, as a strange evolution of humanity from the Neanderthal through. They are part of the same family, but they're different.
And I would say generally that the desire for precision has outstripped the ability to execute well and execute an optimal strategy with precision. We're talking about World War II. The United States was all about precision targeting, and we probably didn't do as well as we could have, and certainly at higher cost, because precision targeting required daytime targeting, which meant getting shot at a lot more during World War II.
This is a good point, because it takes us back to this idea, and you've very kindly taken us back to that juncture that we left off at the beginning of the Second World War. It takes us back to this idea of what is actually precision. And there is a kinetic precision. There is the ability to pinpoint, hit your target. And this was definitely something that American air power thinkers were talking about. They wanted to get a bomb in a pickle barrel from 30,000 feet, I think is what these. I don't know why they spoke about pickle barrels so often, but it was something they were obsessed with. And to hit a mailbox on the corner, you know, this is what they spoke about. So there was most certainly a kinetic precision there. So the ability to strike with pinpoint accuracy. Now, there's also a moral and ethical precision. You know, think of the dam busters, right? Think of the ability of the Wallace bomb to strike that dam with precision, and then the flood, the torrent of water that floods down and kills so many civilians as well, right? That is pinpoint precision, but it doesn't have in its mind the preservation of civilian life. It's a completely different way of thinking about precision and the ends of the bomb. When we come through to the American experience, precision was deeply tied into this progressive notion of the United States being morally and ethically better than the British and the German way of war. Going back to that idea of being better than the old world. And I spoke to Tammy Davis Biddle about this when we were talking about her book, Rhetoric and Reality. And she was saying, you know, this is something that was enshrined when Americans first step off onto Plymouth Rock, right? And so it's part of this progressive movement and this progressive area. And then there's a religious element as well. People working on these technologies, people like Carl Norden, are deeply religious and motivated by their Christianity at this point in order to reduce the costs and the horrors of war. And they think by inventing these systems, these precision technologies, they can reduce the impact of air power on civilians. And so this is where we get to the point where, yeah, there are experimentations going on with drones and all this other stuff that's happening at the time, but the U.S. Army Air Force moves towards the Norden bombsite, something that's so incredibly expensive. I mean, it costs about half as much as the Manhattan Project, the money that was put into this, and the training during the interwar period into the Norden bombsite. All of the belief of the success of the U.S. Army Air Force is built in to this early analog computer that is put inside American crewed bombers to try and achieve this industrial web theory, which colloquially then became known as precision bombing doctrine.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it largely fails due to the technology just isn't there to do precision bombing, so to speak, in the face of suboptimal conditions. Suboptimal conditions being the enemy is trying to shoot you down, suboptimal conditions being the weather isn't perfect. And then the Norton bomb site has its ultimate moment of precision, but the precision is not necessarily needed. Was it on both Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Yeah. It's a strange, this whole story is so odd when you think about it. So as you've mentioned, when it comes down to it, the pre-war conditions, you're testing a Norton bomb site in blue sky conditions in Alabama or in Ohio, and you're hitting that target every single time, right? So you have this misguided sense of belief that this is going to work. When you deploy, you call it suboptimal conditions. I call it Europe. It's cloudy. It's rainy. The weather is a bit crap. And added to that, you have smoke screens going across the cities. You have tires being burnt, oil being set alight. You have fires raging from the bombing that you're doing to those cities. And then, you know, to add insult to injury, you might have just a little bit of, air defense, a bit of flak in there as well. And so all of this added into wartime conditions means that this incredibly delicate early analog computer is worse than useless, because you've got to add in your altitude and your airspeed, and you've got to know exactly kind of where you are when you're calculating all of this in. And that just doesn't work in the experience in the European theater during the Second World War. And they try. Oh my word, they try, at great cost to their own lives as well. Incredibly brave when you think about this. And I've spoken to many a veteran who have gone through my chapters in the book and helped me with this as well. People like Chuck Richardson, who flew 35 missions to hell and back, as he calls it, you know, talking about hundreds of holes in his plane, I think it was his B-17, as he's just about able to make it over the White Cliffs of Dover. But for all intents and purposes, it isn't working. And there's a moment where Churchill calls in Hap Arnold and Spatz, and he's saying, like, what are you doing? What, you know, this isn't working. And they said, look, just give us time. We're adjusting, we're adapting, we're going to make this work. It's, you know, it's going to work. It's got to work, because precision is the U.S. Army Air Force. Let's be clear about that. And the money that's going into it, this has to work. And also, accountability back to the American people. The American people want America to deploy war in this way. They don't want to be seen as being this barbarous old world, as I mentioned before. And Churchill says, fine. All right, well, we'll bomb at night from high altitude, area bombing, and you bomb during the day at low altitude sometimes with your ideas of precision. And then it gets to the point where this continues through the war in Europe, and it starts to change as we move through into the Pacific. So one of these early pioneers of precision who've been working with Arnold, and they've been retaught in this precision bombing strategy at the Air Corps Tactical School over in Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, where so many of them have gone through and learned, they've become disciples of this precision way of war. He tries his best to try and make this work in the Pacific theater and over Japan. There's some who say that in his final run, his final attempt, he perfects it. He gets it. He manages to go through and to score these dead hits on the cities in Japan, and precision bombing works. But Arnold, there's a tragedy here. Arnold's already made the decision to move him off. And in comes the now infamous cigar-smoking General Curtis LeMay, who comes in and has no appreciation of precision and its nuances. He pretends to try and achieve it and then moves towards this area bombing strategy. And there's elements of truth to that. Some of it can be a little over-exaggerated, depending on which books that you read. But I think the fact of the matter is that the U.S. Army Air Force decide at this point that they're going to win the war at any cost and as quickly as possible. And so this is where LeMay moves in, and he uses the bomb site, the Norton bomb site, you know, invented, like I said, by Carl Norden, this deeply Christian, morally motivated chap, to then conduct the firebombings of Japan and things like the firebombings of Tokyo, which have actually more fatalities than a Hiroshima or a Nagasaki. And then, as you mentioned, in the strangest way, the most precise bombardment of the Second World War actually ends up being that, and I mean kinetic here in terms of where the bomb hits, not in terms of morality or ethics, but in terms of where the bomb hits. The most precise bombardment is probably in Hiroshima, where you have that bomb hitting within around 500 yards of Hiroshima Castle, And I was there over the summer where you're standing there at that point on the bridge where it air bursts over the city and it takes out the Second Army base. And so Truman says that, and you go through all the justifications, you know, this is a military target. We hit it with a military target with this bomb. The bomb hit directly on that site. And you say, what's the point in achieving precision with a nuclear weapon? Well, I guess, first of all, you want to make sure that it works, right? And so hitting it within an epicenter within the city that causes maximum damage is what they want. But also there's this political deniability for the Truman administration and for Stimson, who was saying, you know, we hit a military target. We hit it almost exactly on the spot. Now, these aren't the only reasons why the bomb was deployed in this way. I wouldn't want anyone to think I'm misrepresenting the motivations behind the deployment of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are many other reasons that many scholars have covered over time. But I think considerations of precision there at a kinetic level was certainly one of them.
And so under, and we'll call it for the next 15 years or so, from 1945 to 1960, precision just goes absolutely out the window. And the plan is to nuke the Soviets and the Chinese to hell and back and kill half their population if necessary to win the war, right?
Not initially. Right. So this is probably for me the most surprising and fascinating finding of the book. So how do we get from that point where precision is abandoned in, let's say, 1944-45, right? And to the point where all of a sudden we have this revolution in military affairs where precision becomes technically achievable from the Gulf War onwards. Well, that history hasn't been written. And this is where the book fills this gap in the historiography, because all of those who worked on precision bombing don't disappear after the Second World War. In fact, when you come to an independent US Air Force, which finally happens, who is the first head of this? It is General H.H. Arnold, Henry Hap Arnold, the guy who's been working on drones since before drones were even a thing. The person who I said was taught to fly by the Wright brothers, the second person in the US military to learn how to fly. And he's somebody who's been obsessing over this precision. It's ingrained in his blood, in who he is. And so when it comes down to early nuclear planning, and bear in mind that the Truman administration do not approve any of this, there is no discussion to be had at this time about future nuclear strategy and how the United States will deploy force in the event of nuclear war. And that's because Truman is desperately trying to implement international control of the atomic bomb, to have it enshrined within the United Nations, this big initiative that, you know, he's inherited from Roosevelt. And he believes it's going to happen. He writes this letter, as I was going through the archives, he writes to his ambassador who's doing the negotiations for the UN at that time, Clark Eichelberg. He says, you know, I think this is going to happen. There'll be really this peace that can come from the creation of the United Nations. Now, people are writing books about this at the time. There's a book, an edited book, that there's chapters by Einstein and Stillard, and it's called One World or None. The idea that you have to have the atomic bomb in control of this international organization to stop its proliferation globally. And so there has to be one united world to control it, or there'll be no world at all. Now, interestingly, there's a chapter in there by Arnold, the only person from the military who's writing alongside Einstein and Stillard and people like this. And he says, yeah, sure, let's have international control. I completely agree. But until then, I'm just going to keep on playing around with strategy, and we're going to prepare for war until you politically decide what you're going to do. And that's what he does. And so you have these early American nuclear war plans. You have Pincher, Broiler, Off-Tackle, and they are very much deeply linked and almost carbon copies of precision bombing doctrine, because their argument is, well, there's no more important time to have precision when you're striking an enemy than with a nuclear bomb. Because if you destroy their entire cities with these weapons and you leave no other options left, they're going to send them back and destroy your entire cities in a world of proliferated nuclear weapons. And so we're back to this point where precision comes back into the discussion. What they're buoyed by as well is they have this, Spatz has this conversation with Goering, but while he's in prison before he dies. And Goering is held under duress by the Americans.
Who is the head of the German Luftwaffe, so the German Air Force?
Yes, absolutely. The big chap in charge of the Luftwaffe.
The big idiot, really.
Well, he turns and he says,
he was an idiot.
Well, they ask, but they ask him. They say, look, who had more success? Was it the British or was it the Americans? Like, you know, what was more damaging to your war making capacity? What affected you the most? And he says, he sits there with Spatz and he says, oh, the Americans, the American precision bombing. It was the thing that kept us unable to keep up with our war making industry, everything else. He tells them everything they want to hear. Now, there are also some results from the US Strategic Bombing Survey that kind of back this up a little bit. There was more success. And you mentioned the ball bearings, of course, and the oil fields. There was perhaps a bit more success than the Americans thought they were having. And Arnold and Spatz think they're vindicated. This is it. It was all a success. And so you start to get precision back in the parlance, back in the strategic thought. Does it stay there for very long? Well, Arnold dies quite abruptly as he steps down, as he retires. I think he dies in 1950, 51. His memoirs are released around the same time. But just before his death, he starts one of the first think tanks in America, the RAND Corporation, which stands for Research and Development. And he takes $10 million from the U.S. Air Force budget. Actually, LeMay co-founds RAND with him. And the money goes in, and it's there to create this think tank that can not only work on the technical aspects of trying to make precision achievable, because they know it's still not achievable, but also to have a social sciences department, a department of defense intellectuals and strategists who can take on U.S. Air Force military personnel and have an intellectual debate about how to make all of this work. Now, Arnold dies, LeMay starts to rise to power, and LeMay does not want to have anything to do with precision. Oh my God, he's scathing at this point in time. And like you say, he takes American war planning, and especially from 1949 onwards, when the Soviets have got the bomb and the Red Scare and everything else, he takes it down to the most destructive path possible.
And so, can you disentangle these effects, right? So one, Hap is gone and LeMay comes in, and LeMay is bloody-minded, to say the least, right? He takes a maximally destructive approach. And also, Truman's gone, Eisenhower comes in, and Eisenhower is much more, he adopts a mutually assured destruction-esque attitude, although they wouldn't have called it that at the time. But at the same time, previously under the Truman administration, we were working under double-digit numbers of bombs, right? But then bomb production goes up, and so you had to be somewhat precise. And so how much of it was simply, well, you had to be precise when you only had, you know, 50, 60, 70 bombs, but suddenly now that we're cranking out a couple hundred, now we can destroy them, and so we don't have to do that. So we'll take the more optimal strategy of threatening to kill half the Soviet population should the Soviets get an itchy trigger finger.
And the Chinese as well, and populations of Eastern Europe, and the raging fires from LeMay's massive retaliation would have seeped through into Western Europe as well. I mean,
it would have been the end of the world, right? Let's be clear, but it's, you know.
200 million fatalities, I think, are the figures off the top of my head. But I think it's personality, you know, and this book is a history of an idea. And it's an idea to try and achieve precision in war. But this book is called Precision, A History of American Warfare. And it could equally be called Precision versus Destruction. Because really, in essence, when it comes to American air power, that's the battle, that's the argument that's going on within the mind, the body, and the soul of the U.S. Air Force is, you know, should we deploy this moral, ethical, strategic idea of precision in war that we've trusted and perhaps hasn't delivered for us? Or should we be as destructive as possible and not only deter war, but if war does break out, end it as quickly as possible? And for LeMay, it's the latter. It's destruction. And he believes in it as a strategic concept. And so, therefore, he does get a lot of money from the Eisenhower administration specifically to invest in this and to try and make it achievable to that point, like you say, where you have this trigger finger footing of, if there is even a sniff that the Soviets are going to launch an attack on the United States. And of course, those who have seen Dr. Strangelove will know all about the discussions that are going on at this point in time, because it's all based on this period. Well, there would have been this ability to send all of this massive amount of nuclear force to the Soviet Union and what they called then the Sino-Soviet bloc, to the point where those at the RAND Corporation, just to come back to them, are terrified and shocked by this. They've been brought in to try and continue to battle the U.S. Air Force to make sure that precision might be something that's achievable in the future. And they're battling with LeMay, who has this idea that he calls like counter value, right? So you counter the value of your enemy by destroying their entire cities, and hopefully you deter them from then destroying yours by not having a first strike option on the table. For the RAND Corporation, the people from that, they actually keep in line with this precision ethos, and they have what they call counterforce. And it's pioneered by people like Bernard Brody, Albert Wallstatter, William Kaufman, Roberta Wallstatter, Alan Enthoven. And I mention these names because they'll become relevant later. And their idea of counterforce is, again, akin to precision bombing doctrine, as far as I'm concerned. It's the idea of countering the force of your enemy with nuclear weapons. And so you strike the silos, you strike the war-making capacity. Again, none of this is actually technically achievable at this point, but they say if we position ourselves and our entire defense establishment towards it, then we can make it achievable by investing in weapon systems and so forth and going forwards.
And they're right. And we ultimately do that as sort of the first phase of the Cold War expires and we start going towards a missile posture as opposed to a bomber-based posture in many respects. And then we can get that precision again, right? So then is that essentially it? Just the technology matures and so the pendulum swings back to, precision as opposed to...
War is the continuation of politics by other means, right? How many times do we hear this? Well, the politics really mattered. And think back to that election. So we're talking 1960 and Nixon's going to win, right? You know, he's part of the administration. This is something against this upshot, this Kennedy. Where's he even come from, right? And the interesting thing here is the Kennedy team, and I've spoken with a number of those, an absolute privilege in my life to be able to sit down with people like Alan Enthoven, who actually ends up becoming Kennedy's Undersecretary of Defense, and Deirdre Henderson, who's one of the key linchpins of his brain trust. The people she builds, the intellectuals she puts around Kennedy to make his defense policy, right? Now, what LeMay does is he actually pushes RAND out and takes away their security clearance. And so they're basing a lot of their analysis on out-of-date data. But what Kennedy does, and he sends Deirdre actually over to the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica in California, and he taps their ideas and minds, and he brings them in as part of the brain trust. And so these people who have been working on counterforce become Kennedy's people, right? And one thing they have in their mind from out-of-date data is they're worried about this thing called a missile gap. And they program it into Kennedy's mind that there's this big gap between the amount of missiles that the Soviets have and the amount of missiles that the United States have. And it becomes an election-turning agenda issue, right? Because the Eisenhower administration and Nixon, they can't really deny it because you'd be giving away too much kind of national secrets. And I'm not saying it's the only thing that makes Kennedy win, but that margin is so small for that election. But Kennedy does win. And so you have this politician who comes in who doesn't want anything to do with LeMay's massive retaliation. In fact, when he's briefed on it, I think it's by General Lemnitzer when he comes to power, he's in just utter shock. And he finds it quite revolting and disgusting that this is the only option that the US has. And so he brings in those RAND defense intellectuals who have been working with him, who become part of his team, and they start to implement elements of counterforce into US nuclear strategy and planning. And specifically, they introduce elements of counterforce, so hitting military targets instead of hitting civilian targets and entire cities. And what they do is they bring in flexible response. So the ability for the president to have a number of options on the table in the event of nuclear war. And these are the main contributing factors that are brought in during the Kennedy administration under Kennedy and Secretary of Defense McNamara to put American nuclear strategy on a completely different footing, a footing that it continues to have to this day, and a footing that, like you say, really did push us more towards the creation of precision capabilities, to the point where actually it's some of these RAND thinkers that push, not only for nuclear precision, but to create a conventional precision payload, so that in the event of actually having tensions with the Soviet Union, you have a conventional high-yield intercontinental ballistic precision missile that can take out Soviet silos without resorting to the nuclear option. And this was called discriminate deterrence. These were weapon systems that were available by 1988. This was put in place by the RAND researcher Albert Wallstatter and by Freddie Clay. And these systems are not used during the Cold War, of course. When are they used? They're used
during the Gulf War.
The Gulf War. And so now we get through to conventional precision. And if anything, that's the rest is history, as they say.
Right. So that was the RMA, the Revolution in Military Affairs that you spoke of. And, Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, and he has this million-man army, and he has taken the conclusion from the Vietnam War that the United States public is unwilling to sustain mass casualties in pursuit of some far-off foreign thing that they don't really care about. And Saddam was betting that because he had this big, relatively advanced military that was battle-hardened after slugging it out with the Iranians for the past decade or so, that he would be able to not go one for one, but you know, if you can go 4-1, the Americans are still going to throw in the towel at some point with some sort of compromise agreement that he thought would be advantageous to himself.
He thought the American military was still the American military of the Vietnam War, and he hadn't taken into account the fact that there had been this revolution in military affairs, as it's called. And so his whole posturing is that the US can't put up with the death toll that he's going to bring. He says that yours is a nation that cannot sustain 10,000 dead in one battle, and this is going to be the mother of all battles. I think there's something quite worrying about a historian who can spiel off a Saddam Hussein quote off the top of his head. So, you know, you should be concerned by me. But this is important. It's a really important quote because, again, it's the politics and the strategy behind this war. He pins almost everything on this. What happens in reality is you've got this real high-tech mix of bringing actually drones in, the Pioneer drone, to be able to fly over targets and to identify where Saddam's troops are. Those drones then go back, fly onto aircraft carriers. The data's then unpacked. There's an adjust of fire, and you send in cruise missiles, and you take out Saddam's troops. And that's just one part of the air war. Many parts of the air war as well were incredibly destructive. You've got to remember, you know, there were cluster bombs, napalm. I mean, my goodness, there's so much stuff used on Saddam's conscripts. But the precision effect, especially in the early days of the war, the ability to strike key nodes in Saddam's command infrastructure rendered him and his commanders blind and deaf early on in the battle, and the rest was kind of picking it off from there onwards. In fact, there's a fascinating moment where one of the Pioneer drones picks up that Saddam's troops are waving white flags at the drone because they know that if they see the drone, then they know that the precision strikes are coming very soon. And the drones aren't armed at this point, though. Let's remember that. That comes later. And so you have this first moment in history where a human is surrendering to a robot in the sky. And I learned most about this, I'd say, from...
And dear listener, yeah, we have seen a lot of that in Ukraine, where soldiers on both sides, I've seen video of them attempting to surrender to a drone, sometimes successfully and sometimes ending with a explosion.
Yeah, yeah. And what is the obligation? And this is where it comes back to that point about loitering, right? So a drone can loiter, so it can take the time and can consider. And so what is the obligation there of the drone pilot, or, as we spoke about with autonomous systems, to accept that surrender? Because we have Geneva Conventions for a reason. There's lots of discussions about this at this moment in time. But I learned most about this from Lieutenant General Dave Depchula. And Dave was the guy in charge of creating the air power strategy for the war in the Gulf. And, you know, what he said to me, and it was so interesting, he said he was on holiday in 1990, just before the Gulf War starts. And what's he reading, Chase? What's he reading? Well, he's only reading Hayward Hansel's reflections on his failures of precision bombing during the Second World War. He's only reading the architects of precision bombing and air power. And he thinks, well, we have the capability to achieve this effects-based precision bombing now and to make this work. And so he builds his own strategy around this sort of stuff. And so there's an intellectual direct link. This idea of precision jumps through history off the page of this book into the Gulf War, where the technologies are achievable, which I think is what shows the power of a book, doesn't it? But it's just fascinating that not only does the technology at one level skip through history and the Kennedy administration, the Cold War, but it also jumps through history from the pages of the Second World War into the Gulf War.
Yeah, and then that is continued unabated until today, where throughout essentially the entire war on terror, it is very rare that a non-precision strike took place in some manner during the 20 plus years now of the war on terror. And while thousands of civilians have been killed, that ratio of enemy combatant deaths to civilian deaths is probably an order of magnitude lower than any previous war ever fought ever, in terms of allowing the enemy to be killed and sparing the civilian population to the extent possible, the horrors of war. And then, and that was strategy has been continually driven by that same original American ethos of demanding that we fight a better style of war than our enemies, who often blatantly disregard every aspect of the Geneva Convention and sort of broader what I think many Americans would consider the moral imperative to not target civilians.
Well, this is the ambition, right? I certainly agree with you on that. Is it the reality? Well, that is most certainly up for debate, because you know, you look at the, let's go past the Gulf War, let's go through Bosnia, let's move forwards. You know, drones were deployed over Bosnia to record human rights abuses and to provide situational awareness for the Americans, but they weren't armed. Drones were used during the war in Kosovo to help with precision strike, but you know, precision missiles, conventional precision missiles, were certainly used in the Kosovo campaign, to the point where those in charge believe that this was the most precise war in history. There was the idea of this is a perfect war. There were zero NATO combat fatalities. And I remember this one quote from a US officer that said that couples walked along the Danube and dined at sidewalk cafes as the bombardment went on around them. Such was the precision used in the Kosovo campaign. And so there were promises of Kosovo, but false promises, because when you had the tragic attacks of 9/11, that not just tragic, world-changing, shifting attacks of 9/11. The response was to send in these new high-tech systems where they'd finally coupled a precision missile onto a drone, a new variation of the Pioneer that ends up being the Predator. And you have this armed drone that's sent in on October 7th. So we're talking about the first days of the deployed war on terror over Afghanistan to try and hunt and kill the head of the Taliban, Mullah Omar. They find him. He's there. He's in a compound. They're not sure if that compound's a church or not, though. So they want to make sure that they don't, you know, create a politically difficult situation. So someone takes the wise decision to deploy the bomb and fire it at a van outside to scare him out. And then they can take another shot and kill him. And then the dust kicks up in the air and they can't see where he escapes to. And then no one finds him until he dies, we believe, between 2011 and 2013, somewhere else. But imagine the difference, that moment at the beginning of the war on terror, if they'd taken out the head of the Taliban, Mullah Omar. But that's a different side of history, because then you do have the air power campaign, right, in Afghanistan. And there are talks of the United Nations by November 2001 that it's time to move towards peace building. The war is over. They've taken out that vital infrastructure that's there, the command and control nodes, the limited ones that the Taliban have. Exists. Well, exactly. So it doesn't work, does it? This idea of precision bombing doesn't work when you're dealing in a theater like Afghanistan, and we think that we've won and we've driven them out, and it turns out that, you know, porous borders, hiding in mountains, moving into Pakistan.
I want to actually push back on that, because it did work. And, you know, when you compare the American tactics, bombing tactics in Afghanistan versus the Soviet bombing tactics in Afghanistan a generation earlier, the Soviet tactic was pull up a helicopter gunship to the village and spray and pray and kill half the population and drop cluster munitions and whatnot. And the United States certainly could have done that tactic far more effectively than the Soviets did. We are a much richer society, more technologically advanced society, and we could have absolutely depopulated the Afghan countryside to an extent that the Russians tried to do and partially succeeded in, but we could have succeeded. But instead, we did launch a decades-long precision campaign and killed a lot of militants without depopulating the countryside.
But Chase, the US always also gets embroiled in this prolonged ground invasion, right? And I think you're right in one respect. Let me say this. So you're right. In terms of that initial precision strike capability in Afghanistan, when the war aims are to make sure that Al-Qaeda are not able to operate in Afghanistan, then it's worked, right? It's pushing them out. We know from Osama bin Laden's diaries, and Nola Hood has written an amazing book on this, that Osama bin Laden is terrified of the drones. It's taking out the key people in his organization. People can't raise their heads because of it. And so it does work in that respect. But again, back to the politics. the war aims change and it becomes nation building. And you know, I don't need to go into this story for your listeners and for you. I mean, goodness me, you served during the war on terror. You know far more about this than me. But it's in those changed war aims, when the politics changes, that the limits of precision are very clear to see.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that the limits of precision do exist, but I would say that the limits of precision exist and that it was a fundamentally bad strategy that was probably never going to work in Afghanistan. But at the tactical level, the United States had an astoundingly successful campaign of killing bad guys and not killing too many civilians decades.
But the civilian deaths did go into the thousands, Chase. But, you know, you're right. You're right. They achieve pickle barrel precision, right? They can hit a dime on top of a football from 40,000 feet. I mean, if you want to talk about the kinetic ability to achieve precision, the United States can bloody do it, and they can do it every single time. But here's where we start to unpick maybe the broader morality and ethics behind this American ethos of precision as opposed to the technical abilities. And this is why I wanted to speak about those differences of what actually is precision. And I mentioned, of course, the dam busters. Keep that in mind as we move forward and we think, right, well, yeah, the US can achieve pinpoint precision and they can hit that target. But then let's talk about the intelligence and the failures of intelligence and the strikes on weddings and on funerals and the double taps and the signature strikes. The idea that you can predefine a terrorist based on a preset terrorist signature. The idea that a terrorist is male, they're of fighting age, so let's say, you know, 14 years old and above, and they're conducting terrorist activity. And the joke going around the Pentagon at the time is that, you know, some kids doing star jumps is a terrorist training camp. And so there's a confirmation bias that comes with the drone as well. You're looking through this camera and you're almost looking at the battlefield through a straw. And so it becomes very, very difficult then to discern between, and it was difficult in this war as well with asymmetric warfare and the blurring between, you know, civilian and combatant. It became very, very difficult to limit those civilian casualties. And it's a complex situation, right? And let's first of all say, the United States is trying to achieve precision here and trying to limit the cost to civilian lives. And so we can go back to that precision ethos. And, you know, war is never perfect. We know about friction. We know that there's always going to be these casualties. And we have to respect the fact that there are attempts to mitigate the costs of war here through new technologies. But we also have to recognize the flaws of those technologies and the flaws of those strategies. There's cases, and if you read Andrew Coburn's book, Kill Chain, he opened with this transcript of US drone pilots, and they're following this minivan. It's moving through the desert. The people in the minivan get out, and the sun is rising, and they put down their mats, and they pray. And this is what terrorists do before they're about to commit an attack. And so they get the authorization, they take the strike, and then once the strike's taken and they're assessing the impact, you know, they see that there are children there. And then there's this horrible, awful moment where they realize
what every observant Muslim does five times a day.
Well, there you go. Exactly. And so there's that confirmation bias when you're looking through the eyes of the drone. And I have spoken, I've been a visiting scholar of the US Air Force. I've been out to Maxwell Air Force Base. I've been lucky enough to lecture many times now at the Air Command and Staff College. I've spoken to many, many, many drone pilots over the years. And you have drone pilots who have had moments of being conscientious objectors and refusing to take the strikes and being taken out of the drone pods. You have had a high amount of, you know, what is kind of now called moral injury from drone pilots. The idea that a drone pilot is remote, because they are thousands of miles away often, right, in Creech Air Force Base, 70 miles outside Las Vegas, Nevada, the idea is that they're detached from the impact of war. But actually, there is a visceral intimacy of, like you say, tracking someone, perhaps for days, weeks, months, seeing them pick up their kids from school, and then having to kill that person. There's a visceral intimacy of war that has a very detrimental effect on the mental health of drone pilots, and that's something that is continuing to be explored, investigated, and remedied today. So that's the dilemma, isn't it, of drone warfare, of precision warfare, of trying to achieve this. Now, one of the things I'm working on at the moment, though, is not that dilemma, but the consequences of the United States pioneering this technology and the fact that no technology has ever remained for long in just in the hands of the monopoly of the nation states that developed it. Because here's where we live in what we call now the second drone age, where the first drone age is dominated by the United States and its allies and the deployment of drones. Well, today, those drones have spread around the world to at least 113 different nation states, including those hostile to the West, and at least 65 non-state actor groups. And as many of your listeners will know, we have had the tragic news of the first deaths of US military personnel by a hostile enemy drone strike in history, as far as we know, and what we believe to be the first deaths of US military personnel by hostile enemy air power since the Korean War. And so we live in a very different world of proliferated drone threats today.
Yeah, it's not just state actors, but it is the non-state actors. So yeah, various militia groups, like the militia group that struck the U.S. base in Jordan and caused those three deaths and reportedly over 40 injuries. But you also have the Houthis, who originally were importing and still are importing Iranian drones, but now they've set up their own crude little manufacturing center, it seems like. They have some homemade drones, which you did some original research on, right? And so it truly is becoming something that is a very commercializable, very easy, the technology has leaked out and it is relatively common knowledge. A couple of college engineering undergrads can spin up a drone program that was only achievable by a few first-rate nations 20 years ago.
And this is why I wrote the book, I think. You know, we spoke about 100 years of trying to achieve precision. And then rapidly, you've seen this spread of precision capabilities, including precision missiles and drones that have spread around these groups that are hostile to the United States and its allies. And you're right, I hold many hats. I'm a war historian at Cornell University, and I was previously working as a weapons advisor to the UN. I briefed the UN Security Council on this, and I currently work as the NATO country director of the Full Spectrum Drone Warfare Project, supported by NATO SBS. And so I have a very firm footing in the policy frontier of this. And it's what we call, I guess, applied history, learning lessons from this history that I document in the book and trying to help us understand the character of modern warfare and what to expect next. And you're right. We have these hostile states like Iran, who have actually had a drone program since the 1980s. You know, you mentioned the Iran-Iraq War. When Iran had the Iranian Revolution, 1979, Iran had loads of really expensive high-ticket items, right? They had tanks, they had aircraft, but they had no way of maintaining them and no pilots to fly them, because any pilot really took their planes and went and defected, right? So what do? They have a limited ability to tap into the global supply chain of weapon systems and a limited ability to maintain them. And so actually what they choose to do is start to invest in drone technologies from the late 1970s and the 80s onwards. And so Iran has a very long history of having a drone program. And now they're using this to supply a number of groups, non-state groups, as part of this axis of resistance, as it's called, to be a thorn in the side of the West. And it's a very clear, again, back to the politics, I call this a strategy of drone deniability by Iran. They can supply very similar systems to a number of different terrorist groups and violent non-state actors who kind of do their bidding for them alongside doing what they want as well, what the groups want to try and achieve. And so, yeah, I went out to the Middle East. I was one of the few scholars who was able to inspect captured Houthi drones. And yes, yeah, some of them are very high-tech, high-grade military systems, but almost immediately upon receiving them, they're recast in fiberglass. And when they can't get hold of military technology, let's say that Iran doesn't want to supply a certain group anymore, well, they can just tap now into the global commercial supply chain of aviation technologies and of drone equipment to make these systems work. And so you have this hybrid drone of military design mixed in with commercial technologies. And that's important to understand because, number one, it means that these groups can actually operate at their own political will and whim without being just directed by nations like Iran. And so we have to bear that in mind at all times. But it also means we're at a point of uncontrolled unchecked drone proliferation, because it means that these groups now can send these designs to any other terrorist groups around the world, who can then also create fiberglass shells and create their own rudimentary air force.
Them off Alibaba. I mean...
Well, that's very, very true, yeah. And smuggle them over. I mean, so we're at the point in history now, and this is, again, the second drone age, this age of proliferation, where all future wars will be drone wars, and the fact they will have a major drone component. And after neglecting air defense for a generation, you know, since the Korean War, when you don't face a threat, you don't invest in the capabilities to counter it. You invest in air defense against intercontinental ballistic missiles and for deterrence and stopping nuclear missiles coming in. But you don't invest in trying to counter smaller quadcopter-sized systems or other drone systems. And so now we're playing catch-up, and the West is playing catch-up, and we're seeing the costs and consequences of that.
So we only have a few minutes left. I want to quickly get your thoughts on, it doesn't seem like non-state actors are able to produce unmanned underwater vehicles or underwater drones. Is that curve coming? What have you seen?
If Mexican drug cartels can produce drug smuggling submarines, then violent non-state actor groups, criminal gangs, and terrorists are going to be able to create underwater drone systems. It's just a matter of time. Is it the number one thing that worries me? No. The number one thing that worries me isn't even right now autonomous weapon systems and lethal autonomous killing, although that is the one that worries me most in the long term. In the short to medium term, the thing that worries me most is the ability for these violent groups to get hold of drones and precision missiles that can go even further and have that pinpoint precision strike capability. I'm talking intercontinental range precision missiles and drones, because what does the drone afford to a terrorist group? Well, it affords them the ability to literally transcend all of those controls we've put in place post 9/11 to stop these groups smuggling weapon systems over borders, to commit attacks and plant bombs in the West and in the allies of the United States and in the United States, stopping them boarding planes and using civil aviation as weapons. All of these things, shoring up borders, have been the keystone of countering terrorism. But we're moving to a world now where these terrorist groups, like the Houthis, who sit in the south of Yemen, are able to deploy drones. I think probably the drone they have with the largest range is maybe a Samad. I don't know if they have the Shahad yet. A Shahad has 2,000-kilometer range. A Samad is about a 1,500-kilometer range. And so they can send these drones to target the capital cities of our allies. And here I'm talking about Abu Dhabi, to hit key and vital energy infrastructure, to target international shipping to the point where we've seen a massive detrimental effect on international shipping routes in the Red Sea and the blowing up with pinpoint precision of these ships, and the ability of, you know, Iran to send these precision capabilities to nations like Russia, who are then using Shahed 131s and 136s, these precision drones, to target capital cities in Europe. And here I'm talking about Kiev, of course. And you know, imagine these words that I'm saying. This is something that I wouldn't have predicted in my wildest nightmares, is that we now live in a proliferated drone world where these drone technologies are being used against the capital cities of our allies in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, the absolute pinnacle of drone evolution is happening on the battlefields of Europe, where, I mean, I've seen videos, and I'm sure you have, if you haven't, if you're listening, go look up FPV drone racing leagues. I mean, these drones are they're just zooming in between, you know, obstacles at extremely high speed. I can't even imagine controlling it, but, you know, throw a little more sensor power on there and the computer is going to be way better at controlling a high speed drone than a human is. And, you know, there is no way, a 0% chance, that an infantry soldier is going to be able to outrun or outhide or turn a corner fast enough from that drone, and you are dead. And sort of the current drone du jour on the Ukrainian battlefield seems to be some sort of quadcopter rigged with a bomb of some sort, and then some sort of probe on the front. It's just a contact probe, you know, hits the Russian/Ukrainian soldier, explodes. It's a one-way cheap little attack drone. I've seen videos of that, and it's pretty horrifying. And I don't know what the solution is. Is it every infantry unit goes with some sort of electronic countermeasure? Is it every single infantry soldier gets their own Overwatch Sentinel drone? I mean, I don't know.
I'm going to say I don't think there is going to be a perfect solution to this. And I think actually we're going to see, of course, this cat and mouse game of offense and defense and countering, and there are going to be technical workarounds that, you know, solve problems of jamming and spoofing and all of these other technologies that are being brought in. And we've seen this with Russia and Ukraine going back and forth with their drone offense and defense. But it kind of brings us full circle, I guess, just in time for the end of the podcast, because the promises of the drone were to reduce the impact on civilians in war, and perhaps also reduce the impact on US military personnel. The promises of precision, back to that First World War moment, were to make sure that we wouldn't have these muddy, bloody, entrenched wars and these battles of the First World War on European soil. But what do we have instead? We have bloody, muddy, entrenched wars on European soil, and the drones just make it more brutal, more barbaric, and more deadly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I don't know. It's a new revolution in military affairs, I suppose. And we're living through a technological inflection point. I've said on the podcast before, and I think it continues to be true. And I have learned a lot from you, following you on LinkedIn, Instagram, various social media, and I'm going to put all that in the bio. James, it's been a pleasure. And listeners, if you want to learn more about what we've been talking about in much more detail, James has a book out, Precision, A History of American Warfare. Thank you, James.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if I can just add, it's available wherever you get your books, Amazon or everything else. But if you want to buy it directly from the publisher, Manchester University Press, use the code WARFARE30 to get 30% off. So it'll be around, if you're listening in the UK, around 14 quid. If you're listening in the US, around 21 bucks.
All right, $21 in freedom units. For those of you listening to the US Naval History Podcast, thank you very much. If you have any comments, you can send them to me at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. I love getting email. I respond to all of it, even though some of it's a little bit weird, I have to admit. You know who you are. Again, thank you very much. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.